Detective Lee, is that Brian Stephen Smith's foot in them photographs?
Boskoski Ground's first witness to the stand, Detective Brendan Lee, who revealed for the first time that a patrol officer identified Cassandra in the photos almost 5 years ago. One of the lingering questions for the family, why did it take police so long to share what they knew?
To this day, at the Anchorage Police Department, we have not been able to 100% identify the female in the photos.
That's because her remains have yet to be found. In the end, the jury sided with the Boskoski family and decided that with or without remains, Cassandra is not only dead, but also a victim of homicide.
They could have put down unknown, but they put down homicide, and that's huge.
Antonia Comack, an advocate for the Boskoski family, calls this an important victory for all MMIP families. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
This summer, Wyoming State Parks started partnering with Shoshone and Arapaho Fishing Game to bring more folks into their all-women's outdoor program. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman joined the group for a day of climbing.
On a sunny Sunday afternoon, a group of nearly 20 women put on harnesses, tie into ropes, and try their hand at climbing on pocketed limestone rock faces. They're with Wyoming Wildflower Women, which organizes all-women outdoor adventures around the state. Jolene Brown is Northern Arapaho and is a special ed teacher at Arapaho Elementary School.
Honestly, I would never come rock climbing if it wasn't offered. I'm scared of heights, and that's probably not something I would have done. Got out of my comfort zone a little bit.
Brown's been bringing her coworker Kelly Davis with her to programs throughout the summer. As for next year,
I'll try and come back with her, be with her all the way.
I'm Hannah Haberman from Sinks Canyon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 12, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Alex Morgan, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadoff, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest. That's up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. President Biden will block Nippon Steel's acquisition of U.S. Steel. A senior aide to New York's governor is charged with spying for China. And Ukraine's thrust into Russia has not changed the war. First, President Biden's plan to block Nippon Steel's acquisition of U.S. Steel. A shock to the Japanese. In April, when Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio visited Washington, the two countries carved out a number of agreements to promote closer military and economic cooperation. Among them was the promise of major new private investments in each other's country, including an investment by Toyota of nearly $8 billion for electric car battery production in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is expected to create 3,000 jobs. U.S. and Japanese corporations will also invest in artificial intelligence research at both countries' universities. One touchy subject that was left out was the Japanese proposal for Nippon Steel to take over U.S. Steel. Now that issue has been resolved, but in a way that is sure to upset U.S.-Japan relations. President Biden is widely reported to be blocking the purchase, valued at nearly $15 billion. As the Washington Post reports, quote, the deal would have created the third largest global steelmaker in a bid to compete with Chinese rivals on the global stage, unquote. But the deal also comes amidst the presidential election campaign, and politics rules. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have both stated their opposition to the deal, mainly on the basis that an iconic firm such as U.S. Steel should not be sold to foreigners. The Steelworkers Union also opposes the deal, fearful of its impact on pensions and jobs. Democratic senators in Ohio and Pennsylvania agree, yet the CEO of U.S. Steel is among those who regard the deal as essential to protecting jobs and protecting Pittsburgh as a place for attracting foreign investors. That last point on foreign investment in the U.S. has often been touted by the president. His supposed policy is to encourage investment by friendly countries, in part to strengthen alliances against China. But the steel case, as one commentator observes, quote, represents pure protectionism that draws no apparent distinction between our friends and our adversaries. Protectionism indeed, not against Japan, but against Trump. After all, steel workers vote, the Japanese don't. Japan reacted with unhappiness and restraint. Kono Taro, the digital minister, who might become the next prime minister, said, quote, I don't think a government should arbitrarily intervene in a single case. Everyone wants the votes of labor unions in the presidential election, but I hope that the market will not be distorted by such things, unquote. In other words, Japan understands that the U.S. election is determinative and that Biden's decision will not deeply affect Japan's relations with the United States. Next, a senior aide to New York's governor is charged with spying for China. Linda Sun, deputy chief of staff to New York's governor Kathy Hochul, was charged with spying for China, violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act and engaging in money laundering, conspiracy, visa fraud, and alien smuggling. The allegations include friendly ties to the Chinese consulate that resulted in pro-China, anti-Taiwan actions by the governor's office and payoffs in money and kind to Sun. Sun's husband also was charged. He benefited from an export business to China. At Hochul's request to the State Department, China's consul general in New York returned to China. Whether he was expelled, as the governor says, or was simply relieved at the end of his normal assignment, as the State Department contends, is a matter in dispute. No matter, the Chinese government is livid. As a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington said, quote, in recent years, the U.S. government and media have frequently hyped the so-called Chinese agents narrative, many of which have later been proven untrue. We firmly oppose the groundlessly slandering and smearing targeting China. But some of those narratives apparently are true. For example, China has operated police stations in several of the world's cities to keep watch over dissidents. New York City is the latest. When it was ordered closed, the Department of Justice indicted two Chinese citizens for using the police station in Manhattan to go after dissidents. Spying for China has resulted in other recent convictions of Americans. There is an important on the other hand, however, the ongoing exaggeration of the China threat. Congress, under Republican leadership, is about to unveil China Week, which amounts to an abundance of proposed legislation to come down even harder on China. That includes measures to revive the much-reviled China Initiative, a failed effort ended by Biden because of its racial profiling, to identify science researchers of Chinese origin who might be working for China. Elimination of the few remaining Confucius Institutes in the United States, which have brought Chinese culture and language training to schools and colleges that couldn't afford such programs. And obstruction of renewal of the U.S.-China Science and Technology Agreement, which has been a boon to scientific cooperation for many decades. The House of Representatives' ideologically driven anti-China crusade plays into Chinese narratives about smearing China at the expense of programs that are actually beneficial to the U.S. economy and society. Ukraine's thrust into Russia has not changed the war. The Washington Post is reporting on the largest government shakeup in Ukraine since Russia invaded in 2022. The reorganization of President Volodymyr Zelensky's wartime administration comes at a critical moment for Ukraine as Russian forces push forward in the east and unleash a new wave of attacks on cities. Ukraine's surprise thrust into Russian territory at Kursk may have lifted spirits, but it failed to force the redeployment of Russian troops to defend Kursk. It has also prompted a new round of daily Russian attacks on Ukraine's cities, with significant civilian casualties. One wonders how much longer Ukraine can sustain such losses. According to William Burns, the CIA chief, Ukraine's Kursk operation was a significant tactical achievement that did raise questions on the part of Russian elites. Where is this all headed? But not enough questions to change the pattern of the war. Two specialists writing in Foreign Affairs say, quote, "The offensive does not redress the current material imbalance in the war. For now, Russia retains an advantage in manpower, equipment, and ammunition. This advantage has not proved decisive or led to operationally significant breakthroughs, but Russian forces have steadily gained 750 square miles of territory since October 2023, and they have kept advancing in the weeks since Ukraine pushed into Kursk. Recently, the pace of that advance has accelerated, and Ukraine's position looks increasingly precarious along parts of the front," unquote. These writers remind us that while Russia has not diverted its best units to Kursk, Ukraine has, putting important cities at risk. Meantime, Russia is creating other worries. One is Russia's increasing use of criminals and other proxies to carry out attacks in European countries, such as one on a warehouse linked to a Ukrainian business in London earlier this year. Then there is Russian meddling in our election, leading the Justice Department last week to announce criminal charges against individuals accused of funneling millions of dollars toward a sprawling disinformation operation. The operation aimed at supporting Trump and undermining support for Ukraine. Last, here's this report from CNN, quote, "The U.S. has detected increased Russian military activity around key undersea cables and believes Russia may now be more likely to carry out potential sabotage operations aimed at disabling a critical piece of the world's communications infrastructure. Russia is said to have trained a special unit for these operations." In other news, China-Myanmar ties are being frayed by civil war. Basically, China's policy on Myanmar, the former Burma, is to support any group in its civil war that can promise stable relations and protection of China's considerable investments in that country. But that policy is precisely what leads to mistrust on all sides. The Burmese military junta doesn't trust that China has stayed out of the civil war. Some believe it is helping rebel groups operating near the China border. The Chinese side probably doesn't trust the competence of the military to restore order, which may account for its playing both sides. And the rebel groups may mistrust China because, at least publicly, China continues to express support for the military regime and remains its main supplier of weapons. Thus, a combustible situation. Next, the cost of going green in Europe. Rio Tinto, a British-Australian multinational mining company with a less than enviable environmental record, has bought up farmland in Serbia to produce the first battery-grade lithium for electric vehicles. That idea has its supporters in Europe, but does not sit well with Serbians. The European Union sees lithium production as essential to ending dependence on Chinese EVs and thus helping meet climate change goals. But Serbians see more value in trees and farmland. To them, the lithium mine means poisoned water and air. As for the Serbian government, it is caught between conflicting forces, large public protests to end the project, a boost to employment once lithium production begins, and the promise of membership in the European Union, which supports Rio Tinto. The Biden administration has come down on the side of the mining company, by the way, viewing the project through the lens of competition with China. Time is running out for glaciers. Glaciers are melting far more rapidly than anyone expected. These critical sources of fresh drinking water, water for agriculture, and water for plants and animals are disappearing worldwide, a sure sign of global warming's impact. Some examples of disappearing glaciers have come from the Washington Post recently. Venezuela is now glacier-free, losing its last one this year. New Zealand has lost at least 264 glaciers. The Western United States has lost about 400 glaciers since the middle of the 20th century. Swiss researchers tallied more than 1,000 small ones lost. East Africa has less than 2 square kilometers of total glacial ice remaining. And that could be just the beginning. Scientists worry about the next stage, glacier collapse. Next, a carbon offset scam in Mozambique. In Africa, the great majority of families cook their food over an open fire, a practice that is harmful to health and requires cutting down trees. One answer to both those practices is supposed to be kerosene cookstoves. A Washington Post investigation of a program in Mozambique, run by DC-based SeaQuest Capital, has found that the company failed to deliver on providing kerosene stoves that would reduce deforestation and protect the lungs of users. The idea was to benefit poor Africans while also producing carbon credits that large corporations could then buy to offset their planet warming emissions. SeaQuest would calculate the amount of carbon emissions that the stoves reduced and would sell that figure to the corporations, which would then claim them as evidence of contributions to fighting climate change. What actually happened is that SeaQuest's clay and metal stoves were cheaply made and functioned poorly. When used indoors, they produced deadly gases, and their use was never as widespread as the company claimed. The Washington Post concludes, quote, "The SeaQuest saga illustrates some of the shortcomings that endanger the unregulated carbon credit system, according to interviews with dozens in the industry. Companies voluntarily buy and sell carbon credits worldwide with little or no transparency. Those selling the credits have significant leeway in how they estimate the emission savings," unquote. Moreover, the environmental benefits are equally difficult to calculate. Claims of great benefits, such as SeaQuest made, cannot be verified. Finally, two updates, one on Venezuela, the other on the South China Sea. President Nicolas Maduro has so far survived every effort to get him to step down following his clear-cut election defeat in Venezuela by Edmundo González. Far from resigning, Maduro has stepped up arrests of the opposition. González is now subject to arrest, but he has fled to Spain. Several opposition leaders have taken refuge in the Argentine embassy, which Maduro's henchmen have surrounded. Argentina has protested and urged Maduro to allow the opposition leaders to leave the country, but so far he has refused. Instead, he has ordered Argentine diplomats to leave the country and has revoked Brazil's right to represent Argentina's interests, putting the asylum seekers at even greater risk. Further aggravating the situation is that Argentina has asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrants against Maduro and other senior government officials for possible crimes against humanity, allegedly committed during post-election protests. And in the South China Sea, the China-Philippines face-off is worsening. The State Department strongly condemned China's Coast Guard for having, quote, deliberately collided 3 times with a Philippine Coast Guard vessel, causing damage to the vessel and jeopardizing the safety of the crew. China's foreign ministry blamed the Philippines for the incident, despite video footage clearly showing that the Chinese vessel rammed the Philippine ship. The European Union got into the act for the first time, condemning China's action. Beijing responded by urging the EU to stay out of China's affairs. As this confrontation worsens, look for the U.S. to start escorting Philippine ships, posing a direct challenge to China. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's an election year, and a lot of focus is being placed on the presidential election, but it's not the only race that will have an impact on people's lives. A lot of that comes down to state and local elections, and in order to make the best decision on where to cast their vote, voters need information. That's where the Rural Organizing Project and their stand guide come in. To learn more about that, I'm speaking with Emma Renee Derning from ROP. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for stopping by to talk with us about this. So we got to get some primer in here for folks who may not know. What does Rural Organizing Project do?
Rural Organizing Project is an organization that's all over the state, and we are made up of over 75 volunteer-run organizations that are autonomous, so they set their own priorities, but everybody's working to advance democracy and human dignity. And our job as a network is to build each individual group's ability to make the change they want to see at the local level and come together in important statewide issues that folks agree to work on. And election season is one of those times where everybody comes together to make the best we can out of this opportunity.
Well, I understand ROP does a lot of organizing around the election, and we'll talk about those things. But one of them is the stand guide that you put out every 2 years to help with voter education. What can you tell me about those guides?
Yeah, our stand guide is a newsprint guide. So it's like a little mini newspaper, just one sheet. And we distribute tens of thousands all over the state in English and Spanish every 2 years, as you said. And the guide is designed by and for small town and rural voters to break down confusing statewide ballot measures and the rhetoric that we hear around election time and try to make tough issues as accessible as possible through focusing on our shared values of democracy and human dignity.
What are some of the things that are in this year's guide?
Yeah, every year we have information about the statewide ballot measures, and so we give people easy to understand language of just what the heck this measure does, because sometimes it can feel really confusing when you get that ballot in the mail. And then our board also takes positions on those ballot measures, looking at whether they advance democracy or take away from the democratic process. So we have in-depth info on the ballot measures on one page. We also have information about what local elected officials are responsible for. So on the front page, you'll see your city council and what the city council does. They have responsibility over housing. They have responsibility over city police, if your city has police, parks, road and sewer, that sort of thing. And we try and give people a quick rundown of what a county commissioner is responsible for, what the state government does, who the secretary of state is, like what is that position? A lot of things that I certainly didn't learn when I was going to school and have had to learn through the process of getting involved. This year, we also are sharing information about Project 2025 because we've been hearing that a lot of folks are concerned about it and feel that it's going to have a big impact on this election cycle. So we're breaking down what Project 2025 is and sharing our vision for rural communities and how we can live and thrive everywhere across Oregon that we live.
What are some of the actions that you're encouraging people to take with these stand guides?
Yeah, the stand guide is a tool that our groups order however many they want to be able to have conversations with their neighbors. This year, on the outside of the guide, before you even open it up, it says, "Hey neighbor, what's on your mind?" And it guides folks through an open-ended conversation to help connect people. I think election time is often, wow, I'm getting so many texts from strangers and they just want my money or they want my vote. And we try and take elections as an opportunity to build relationships and to start working on a longer term scale. We do care that people vote and participate in democracy on November 5th, but democracy also happens all year round. And so our groups take this as an opportunity to get the information out that their neighbors need to be able to make informed decisions, but also maybe meet some new friends that want to get involved in their work to stop evictions in their town or their work to make sure their community is safe and welcoming to everybody that lives there. So the tool is really here to kind of kickstart conversations. A lot of people are taking them and knocking on their neighbors' doors, or they're bringing them to candidate forums that they're either hosting or participating in. And on the inside, we have some suggested questions to ask candidates that are targeted at kind of that specific level of office, what they have responsibility over. And let's really interview these people. We're hiring them to work for us. So let's figure out if they share our values and are going to be responsive to our priorities and our needs as a community. Other folks are mailing them. We mail them to everybody that we have an address for, and some of our groups will also pop them in the mail and have an extra little note on them that's, hey, make sure to come to our meeting next month. So there's a lot of different ways that people use them. Some people want to bring them to their pride event or community potluck and just share it with their neighbors at their at the post office or wherever they're connecting with people. But the tools ideally get an information people need and also starting a conversation about how we can work together to move beyond this election season, because obviously one vote is not going to solve all of the challenges that we're currently facing, but it could put us in a good position to solve those challenges in the coming years.
Well, it's not just stand guides that ROP is working on this election season. I understand there's some other preparatory actions that your organization is working on. What are those?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we put the stand guide out. It's a newsprint guide and it's a paper copy. We also have a digital guide that people use. And in the last probably 4 years, especially since COVID, when folks were trying to get creative about how to reach out to their neighbors, we started to get requests for content in different formats. And this is election specific, but also outside of elections. A lot of our folks are interested in building power and building their megaphone through local radio or like KBOO or newspapers or social media. And so this year we're starting a Rural Roots Rising strategic communications cohort where volunteers who are particularly eager to build their skills around communicating with their neighbors and want to collaborate with other folks from different parts of the state are gathering together virtually. And we're going to build a team that's focused on radio, a team that's focused on social media video content, a team that's focused on op-eds, et cetera, just based on who's interested in what platform. And we're going to be creating content that's election related, but is not in newsprint. It's able to be more agile and more responsive to whatever might come up in September, October, and November, and then also be part of responding to what the results were and where we're going from here. So that group will be creating specific content that they're excited about and is relevant for a statewide audience. And then the other piece that is even more responsive than that is that folks are quite concerned that this election people will face threats and intimidation for trying to exercise their right to vote, or that election officials and county clerks and the Secretary of State might face harassment or intimidation in trying to protect our free and fair election cycle. So part of what we're doing for that is building infrastructure at the county level of, okay, what does your community need to be most prepared for this? Another part of what we're doing is partnering with a national hotline called the Election Protection Hotline. And you can find more info about them at 866-OurVote.org. But this hotline has trained lawyers that volunteer to answer calls. They answer calls in, I think, 13 different languages or something that we as a six or seven person staff team can only dream of doing on our own. So they'll be able to answer easy, like kind of what's your rights or where's your ballot drop box kind of questions. And then we will be answering, along with our partners at Common Cause and potentially others in the state of Oregon, Oregon-specific calls that require a broader or a more kind of organizing-based approach of like, oh, wow, there's people rallying outside of the county clerk's office and trying to get them to stop counting ballots. Okay, let's bring our community together and really have a coordinated response at the local level. So we're really excited to be partnering with this national organization as well as organizations in the state of Oregon to protect our communities and make sure that we can have a free and fair election this cycle where everybody who wants to can fully participate. And a lot of our members are distributing information about the hotline, because if you don't know about the hotline, you can't get support from it. But that's the third piece that we're really prioritizing this cycle is making sure everybody can vote and has the information they need to vote.
To your mind, what is the importance of focusing on local elections, especially for rural Oregonians?
I think a lot of focus is placed on the presidential election. It's the most money goes into it. The national media covers it very heavily. But when we look at what has the biggest impact on your everyday life as an Oregonian, often it's things that the county commission or the city government or your school board is doing. What your kids are learning in school has a lot more to do with what your school board is putting forward and how they're supporting or not supporting the school staff than it does with who's in the White House and who the president is at one particular time. And I think a lot of folks feel like, oh, my vote doesn't matter. It's so big. We have how many millions of people in the U.S.? One vote isn't going to make a difference. But in city or county races, last election votes, literally like 1 to 3 votes made the difference between this city councilor or that city councilor, or this ballot measure passing or this ballot measure not passing. And Grant County was not able to fund their pool because they lost by just a handful of votes on that bond measure. So I think people can feel that impact more specifically. When you think about the county commission is responsible in many counties for public health, for funding like mental health resources in a local community, for making decisions about housing resources and how they're distributed or how they're spent in a county. And a lot of that really hits close to home. Same with state government. We have so much of our school system is funded through state dollars as well as federal. But you know, all these pieces are really tangible. Like it really, you feel it in as you're going about your day or your week. But the media that we have access to doesn't necessarily tell you what your city councilor is thinking or what that candidate who's running for county commission is going to do with that power. So it's really up to us as small communities to get information out about who these people